morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Alan Stroud with Mike Small on behalf of the defendant appellant Charles Jones. In coming to what we submit are the two issues that, subject to any questions you have, we'd like to focus on the most. The first is our first issue raised in the brief regarding the jury veneer and jury questionnaire issue. And the second that I will address involves the failure of the trial court to give the requested special instruction with respect to tax evasion. Starting back with the jury questionnaire issue, the jury selection procedure was somewhat unusual in this case. We started in Monroe, in the Monroe division. After 2 days, we were unable to pick a jury because Mr. Jones was a well-known political figure in the area. We initially moved for a change of venue because of the number of jurors who, or prospective jurors, who indicated that they could not be impartial. The government joined that. We then, so the court transferred the trial to Shreveport. And in connection with that, and what I'll refer to as the first trial, the trial court, before the first trial in Shreveport, used a special jury questionnaire that was jointly submitted by the parties that included two questions, and I paraphrase, but of course the exact wording is in the brief. One question was, are you more inclined to think that a public official accused of a crime is guilty? And the other was, are you less inclined to believe a public official than someone who is not? Those questions triggered a one-third response to of jurors saying they'd be more likely to think a public official is guilty, and about a quarter of the veneer that they'd be less likely to believe a public official.
I think let's talk about this, because it seems to me that the, you know, the first two trials, or at least that used the general question, it was a general question. And in a general question, anything can pop in your mind. It seems to me that the question that was used on the veneer was such that it was specific to this particular defendant. It reduced it to this particular defendant, not only whether or not that would affect the verdict, but also whether the believability of this individual. And it seems to me that that is the proper focus of asking if there is prejudice as to this particular individual, who happens to be, and it was acknowledged that he was a former senator and representative, I believe.
And everything you just said about the sequence is correct. But our argument has never been that those questions and yes answers on those questions were intended to say, okay, if the prospective juror says yes, we're going to excuse that juror for cause. The purpose of the questionnaires was to trigger further inquiry through voir dire. For example, before the first trial, some of the prospective jurors who answered that question yes, when questioned further by the court, said, well, I could put that bias aside, or it's not that strong. They were kept in the pool. But we know at least four before the first trial said, my feelings are so strong on this issue.
Before the first trial?
Yes.
But we're dealing with the second trial now.
I realize that, and I was trying to.
You didn't object? Did you enter some sort of general objection to the jury for the second trial, that they were all tainted, or that, I mean, how did you go through your objection process at the second trial, the one we're dealing with now?
Actually, the objection process happened before the trial started.
Right. After this jury was selected, did you make some, again, I know you don't have to re-urge your objection, but, I mean, it seems to me you went through, you picked jurors, you exercised your challenges for cause or peremptory challenges or whatever, and you've got this jury. And they were all questioned about this bias, weren't they, or potential bias?
But not the same way as in the first trial.
Well, I understand that.
And I think to go through the sequence quickly of why I believe we preserved our objection is, after the first trial, the courts asked the parties to submit make submissions on whether they wanted to change the questioning.
No, I'm not suggesting you didn't preserve this
okay.
error. I'm just asking, it seemed to me you went through the normal process and you weeded out any that voiced a concern about a public official.
And let me tell you why I think we didn't, and this is probably getting to the both of the questions that you've asked. And in fact, the government says this in their brief, so we may all agree on the general proposition, but just disagree on the consequences. A person is more likely, I think, to answer a general question about bias against public officials, yes, than when asked about a particular individual because they're disinclined to say, I'm going to be biased against Mr. Jones. The broader question, the importance of it was that it caught more people who truly did have a bias that they would not otherwise have disclosed.
You think it caught more people?
Well,
I mean, maybe this second jury thought this defendant was the most honest politician that had ever come down the pike. And you know, there are a lot of politicians that people think that about.
Well, we do know that the number of yes answers to these two questions went down about 50% in the second trial. Now, you're correct in some ways, depends on the composition of the veneer. I suppose we can never know, but all we can go with is the numbers and
I'm not so sure that I even agree with your first proposition, that is, that it was narrowed. But because what he asked is that this individual, you know, was told that they served both. Would that he was a former public official, affect your ability to determine, you know, guilt and innocence? That he was a public official, which is tantamount to the question that was asked before. Now, it relates to this individual, but the question is, because he is a public official, is that going to affect the guilt and innocence? And then you go back. Same thing. Would that affect his credibility? In essence, the general question, there's not much difference between that general question to make any difference. It seems to me, because it does capture what you're concerned about, and that is that this individual was a politician, elected politician, and would that have any effect on these two aspects of the jury's duties?
And I understand that point. But our experience at the level and during this process was when the judge would ask questions in the courtroom generally, especially about bias against Mr. Jones, not a hand would go up.
What you're saying is, was this question too narrow? And what I'm suggesting to you, were the first two trial questions too broad? I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, as a matter of law, was this panel required to be asked that question in the form that it was asked? And that's where it gets kind of dicey, it seems to me, from your perspective.
I understand, Your Honor, and I would like to emphasize before leaving this issue that our argument is not that this question has to be asked in every case.
No. But what you, I think the gist of your argument, and let me see if I can capture it, is this. That question would open up other questions that may lead to a disqualification. I mean, that's the thrust of your argument. Is
precisely based on what happened in the first trial, where we ended up hearing jurors say, "I couldn't put it aside, no matter what, because for my whole life I've felt like public officials are probably crooked."
Mr. Straub, on your last issue, it's not one of the two you mentioned, but
yes,
we're running out of time, and this is extremely important for our purposes. You're claiming that the tax loss calculation for sentencing purposes was erroneous because of the inclusion, because the Wiley fee, for want of a better term, was included. The government, in its brief, goes to great lengths about your failure to preserve this issue at sentencing, and it surprised me that in your reply brief you never address the government's contention. You never dispute that, which would lead one to believe that you didn't raise this at sentencing. Yet some independent checking by our panel notes that sentencing transcript 25, Jones' counsel stated, in the alternative, if the court concludes that the Wiley fee should be included in the calculation of unreported income, we would ask that the court apply credit for the amount paid by Mr. Jones on the Wiley fee, which came to $139,703.
Yep.
Is that the only way the objection was made?
It was, no, sir. It was first made in the objections to the PSR. It was made in the sentencing memorandum. At the hearing itself, I think I incorporated our arguments from the sentencing memorandum.
Did you ever say to the judge, you cannot include this because this amount was paid before the crime at issue, not afterwards? As I understand it, if it's paid afterwards, it can't be deducted, but if it's paid before, it can be deducted. Did you make that point to the district court?
I believe we made it in brief. I don't know that it's going to be repeated in the transcript of the sentencing.
Well, see, I doubt we have the brief in the record that we could take a look at it. Normally we don't look at things that aren't in the record.
I understand.
And why wasn't this responded to in your reply brief?
I had thought in my reply brief when the government raised the issue that it was going to be plain error review, that our argument was that under any standard of review, it was error, even if you determine that it's going to be plain error.
But that's almost an argument that it is plain error review. That's not the best argument. You should, if you think it's not plain error, you should tell the court, because it's a very different standard.
Well, then I will affirmatively say, and perhaps should have better addressed this in the reply brief, we think the issue was preserved because we argued it to the district court.
It's in your PSR, and you discussed it in some capacity in your sentencing transcript. Is that correct?
Absolutely, because the contention was clearly
PSR objections is what I meant. Yeah. Okay.
Because the contention was clearly made to the district court that it should not be included and that it was not subject to the guideline rule that says that you don't include payments after the offense because the offense actually was subsequent to the payment, which was the amended return. So that the same argument we're making to you was made to the trial court.
Let me ask a question as to history. I believe that there was a payment made of $139,000, but it was made on the corporate tax, not in the individual tax return.
That is correct.
Okay, and your argument is that's the functional equivalent of actually paying the individual tax return, and that's why you should get credit, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Because the conviction on the underreporting on the 1999 return arguably includes not putting the Wiley fee on the personal return. If he, before that offense, had paid the IRS $139,000 on the Wiley fee through the corporate return, which he in fact did, our contention is that should be credited because the payment was at least made and it was made before the offense occurred.
But you agree that it was not paid, that $139,000 was not paid into the private return?
Yes, sir.
It was only paid after the commission of the crime into the private return.
Well, it's always just been paid on the corporate return, and now it's sitting there.
Well,
is there anything in the record as to whether, I understand he paid it on this quote corporate return close quote, and the corporation was no longer in existence when he paid it? Was that refunded? Did the IRS? Is there anything in the record by the IRS asking where is this coming from?
The money was not refunded. What was the testimony at trial was that the IRS will hold it until the outcome of this case and then decide what to do with it in terms of credits and so forth. So it was not refunded. And on that issue, we believe the offense occurred subsequent to the payment. And I see that I'm seconds away from time, so subject to any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. You still have 5 minutes. Ms. Kessia.
Good morning, Your Honors. I will pick up with the loss calculation. The district judge filed a written reasons for ruling on objections to the pre-sentence report, and they are in a sealed envelope in the record as document 134. And in that statement of reasons, he said that defendant had clearly committed tax evasion well before he made his earliest payment on the 1999 corporate return on October 24th, 2002, as he had already filed a return that underreported his income. Thus, he cannot receive the credit for the 139703.
Underreported his income on his private, on his individual tax return.
He had underreported it on his personal, and the amended return that occurred was false also. And the corporate return was filed because the defendant realized he was caught red-handed with this huge fee, and so he had to figure out a way to make it good, and at least that's the supposition, and that's what can be inferred from his conduct. He had already filed a personal return which eliminated this huge fee, so he could not really go back and amend it and say, I just forgot that one. It was just too obvious. So that's why the corporate return appeared. It was the 1999 corporate return was the first and only one of two corporate returns filed for this corporation. The second return, no taxes were due because no income was shown on it, so it need not have been filed for the year 2000, and that was mentioned at the, I believe, in the sentencing memorandum and in trial by one of the agents who testified.
How could the district court have determined that it occurred before? Because if the amended return was filed in October of 2003, and he had made the payments in October of 2002, how could the court have found that he had committed the offense before? Because it's the filing of the amended return, isn't it, that's the commission of the offense?
The tax evasion is what the judge referenced here. The tax evasion occurred beforehand.
How? Because it occurs when he files a return that doesn't accurately reflect.
The filing
was October 2003.
The filing of the return is count two, I believe, is the one we're referencing here. The account is count two. And the judge is referencing count three, the tax evasion.
When did that occur?
The tax evasion? It occurred over quite a stretch of time. The there were only four evasive acts that occurred after the statute of limitations had run. And those four are listed at the, they're the last four.
But talking about the failure to report the Wiley fee, that would be the evasion on the Wiley fee. And that did not occur until October 2003, did it?
No, Your Honor, it occurred before then.
When did it occur?
His evasive conduct occurred. That was the filing of the amended return.
Yes, it was.
But the evasion occurred over a period of time. The government
when did it occur? I want to know when it occurred.
It's an ongoing type offense, Your Honor. It's not occurring at one particular moment because he was never really, it was attempted evasion. And he did this by getting cashier's checks, by secreting the money in.
Let me try this again. It occurred when he got the money, if you want to do it your way. And when was that?
When he actually got the check for
yes.
the Wiley fee?
That couldn't have occurred before that. So that would be the first date that it occurred.
He got the Wiley fee in the part of it in April of 1999, and he got the second half, or second portion, smaller portion, in August of 1999. And he converted those checks that he received from the law firm in Mississippi. He went to the bank in Mississippi and converted them into cashier's checks because
so
the IRS
didn't
even know he was.
So you believe it occurred beginning in 1999 is the answer to my question, correct?
That's when he began his evasive action.
Okay, that
action.
Was my question. That's when did it begin? And I just heard over a long period of time and this kind
right.
of vague
he began,
thing.
He began it then, but he was evading before then with the Sims fee, the
but
large
But it doesn't
fee.
Matter because I'm trying to determine when he evaded the on the Wiley fee. Oh. Because that's the relevant
he
determination.
He began and continued a series of actions to hide that fee from the IRS. That is correct. That's when he began that.
Now, at sentencing, I understand we're going to see objections to the PSR. We're going to see the judge's statement of reasons under seal. At sentencing, when they said, Your Honor, we'd like you not to include the Wiley fee, did they ever make the argument, did they ever raise the points that they are making on appeal about because the Wiley fee was subsequent to the crime, not before hiding the Wiley fee, for want of a better term? Did they ever go into particulars with the judge, or did they just give him this general blanket statement, please don't include the Wiley fee?
Your Honor, I believe it was a general term, but I would like to review it myself to make sure that that is correct. But I believe it was a general objection. He paid this amount of money, and it should be applied to his personal taxes because by that time, everyone was in agreement that he should have treated it as personal income. And the only reason it was treated as corporate income was for the
show.
Right, for show. And then also he...
And because he couldn't pay
without
almost admitting what he has
that
done.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Because he would have had to amend his return,
yes.
His personal return.
Yes.
So he looked to this defunct corporation to file a return.
I believe that.
Is that the only time the corporation ever filed a return?
It's the only time it ever filed a return that taxes were owed on. The subsequent one was the year 2000. The corporation had been in existence since about 1990, and it had... It had lost its charter for failure to pay its registry fees each year.
Now, that was just a sentencing guideline issue. It's not an act of evasion in and of itself, yay or nay, because I think the judge made some statement about that, or at least you may have made some statement in your brief.
Which is not the act of
the filing of a tax
Of the tax
return. A liability in the wrong return.
Right.
Let me just say, quote, on purpose, end of quote.
Yes, it was purposely done essentially to hide the fact that he had totally understated his personal income.
And that's what the judge found.
I believe that is what the judge found. He doesn't go into explicit detail about it, but he does say that he clearly committed tax evasion well before he made his earliest payment on the corporate return. So that's essentially what he found. Now, going to the voir dire issue, the government contends that the measure is not the difference between the voir dire for the first trial and the voir dire for the second trial. It's really whether defendant was tried by a jury that was, for all intents and purposes, chosen and was not biased against this defendant and did not have any bias, and it was properly chosen. Defendant makes much of the fact that so many people in the first voir dire for the first trial, the June trial, answered the question positively. I call to the court's attention the last few jurors who were called to the back to discuss their answer because they had answered yes, that they had a problem with public officials. Almost every single one of them by this time, it was becoming clear that the jurors were not understanding the question as worded. And when it was explained to them, it was, oh, yes. One of the jurors even said, I meant to answer no, but I answered yes. And also, many of these jurors had a combined problem. They had a problem with the fact that the defendant was a public official, according to that questionnaire, But then they also, many of them, had problems with the IRS, and they expressed that. Many of them had problems with people who don't pay taxes. Apparently, these are tax-paying individuals who resent that. Many of them expressed a concern that they had a difficult time considering an individual who was indicted. They just automatically thought that if a person was indicted, they probably were guilty.
And all of these people explain their yes to the general questions by those specific answers that
many of them did, yes. Some were obviously confused, and they were excused. There were several who were obviously confused, and I hate to force you to read all of that, but there's a lot of testimony in the voir dire, but the particular
now,
ones are
about
at the
end. We're talking
about
the voir dire at the trial, at the judgment on appeal.
I'm sorry.
We're talking about the voir dire for the second trial, not the first trial.
And for the second trial, you had...
Now, wait. Are you saying we should go back and read the voir dire from the first trial?
No, Your Honor. I'm really not. But it does explain at the very end, those last few jurors, it explains why the judge said, this question is not clear. We need some new questions. And the judge asked the parties to come up with a set of questions to replace these two questions because it was so obvious that the jurors were confused.
At the first trial.
At the first trial, correct. And the parties could not agree. The government presented a series of questions and the judge accepted those as being clearer and more to the point because they dealt with the individual who was before the court at that time and covered bias with respect to anyone's to his having served as a public official. And the same thing happened there. Many of the individuals were individuals who had IRS problems or problems with the IRS, as well as they thought that a person who was indicted was automatically guilty in their view. And those people were discharged, were excused. But the questions as asked were not confusing. The jurors understood them, and those few people who did have a problem with public officials were able to explain why they did.
And was this done before the entire venire, or did the judge and counsel question them privately?
They were questioned privately. I believe the questions were asked on an actual questionnaire, and then those who had answered the questions were pulled to the back. And there were a number of other questions that required that they be questioned on those also. It wasn't just the public official issue. But the defendant has not alleged that the jury that actually convicted him was in any way biased. He is simply alleging, hypothetically, that they weren't asked these other questions and these other questions should have been asked. Is there anything else?
No, thank you very much. Ms. Strun.
On the sentencing issue, the Wiley fee was never charged as an act of tax evasion. And the calculation of loss for sentencing purposes involved two parts. The loss as a result of tax evasion was calculated by the amount of taxes that Mr. Jones owed during the alleged period of evasion and didn't pay. That's one calculation that we have not challenged. Then there was a calculation for how much was lost by failure to report what the government was said was the proper amounts on the returns. That's where the Wiley fee was added to the loss amount because it was not reported on the 1999 amended return filed in 2003. The original 1999 return filed in 2001 could not have been charged in the indictment because it was outside of the prescriptive period.
But, right. But this is a sentence. The 139 comes in because you want a credit for that amount.
Yes, sir.
That's the specific issue. Whether it was charged or not, the specific issue is should that money that was paid into the IRS or paid to the IRS through the corporate return, not the individual return, whether that should be credited or not. That's the simple issue for that 139.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because generally at sentencing, the court can look at a lot of things that aren't specifically charged. He can look at crimes, other crimes for criminal history, et cetera, and we just have to read the sentencing transcript. But I repeat that all of this should have been hashed out in your reply brief, if not in your opening brief, but we'll take what we got.
Absolutely, and I'm not suggesting that the judge couldn't consider uncharged conduct, but in calculating the loss and trying to determine what the loss was on counts 1 and 2, he included the full amount of the fee without a credit for the payment. And I believe that, notwithstanding any weakness on my part in the reply brief, that you'll find from the record that this was urged before the trial court. Briefly, with respect to the jury questionnaire issue, the jury was asked a lot of different questions. That's true. And it wasn't just asked about the public official questions. The government proposed questions about bias against the IRS and so forth. But with respect to the public official questions before trial one, and I don't think whether you review the whole transcript or look at the specific excerpts we put in our brief, they were not confused about that question. The four jurors who were excused for cause on that issue were crystal clear about that question, about not being able to overcome that.
Are we again talking about trial one or trial two?
Trial one as a predicate to saying why it shouldn't have been changed for trial two. But I think that's where we have to start, to say whether or not it was error to modify something that we contend at the end of the day was working. And the whole ultimate issue and the whole ultimate test, I understand that there's wide discretion on how the trial court can conduct voir dire, but in this, in the Beckner case and in other cases, this court has said the ultimate inquiry is were the questions sufficient to permit defense counsel to make a, quote, reasonably knowledgeable choice about whether a juror should be disqualified. And for the reasons we've urged in brief, we think that's true before the first trial, but not before the second trial because of the narrowing of the question. And that's why, Judge Barksdale, we have referenced the first trial for comparison to what happened later when less jurors were caught, ultimately leading to the risk that if we missed even one before the second trial, who we would have gotten for cause before the first trial based on bias against public officials, the defendant did not receive a fair trial.
And just for the purposes of this audio, the first trial you received a change of venue, and you received that for the second, didn't you?
Yes, sir. Both of the
tried in Shreveport.
Both were tried in Shreveport.
Right.
Yes, sir. No further questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strunk. Your case is under submission. The next case is